Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Humans go to great lengths to locate their lost fur babies. Telephone poles have long been a popular posting site for lost and found flyers. But the internet has become another popular option, and the Ohio nonprofit Pet FBI has tapped into that potential. Now Google has awarded an AdWords grant to Pet FBI. Joining us now is the founder and executive director of Pet FBI, Marisa Finelli. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
You founded Pet FBI in 1998. How does the website work?
Well, it's a database, basically, and also information about what to do. So if you've there's a set of steps that we recommend. First, you would check the database. So let's say you've lost a dog.
Right.
So you would check the found reports. And if you don't find...
When you look at the found reports, how do you even...
Oh, well, there's...
It's got to be big.
The first page is you have a list of search criteria. One is the
breed.
Status, which could be lost, found,
okay.
or reunited. You can see how many pets have been returned to their owner. Next step would be species. It could be dog, cat, bird, reptile. Believe it or not, we've actually had some lost turtles.
Uh-huh, sure.
And ferrets. Also, small mammals is another category. People lose rabbits and guinea pigs and things like that. And then there's a time frame. You can select, you can target your search. And this is one aspect in which our site is superior to many others, where you can't do a targeted search. You can't select, you know, which period you want to look at. Facebook is falls back, you know, in that respect. And Craigslist as well. Those are both popular venues for posting reports, but to find the necessary information is pretty difficult because you don't have these search criteria. And then there's a geographic criterion. You can use a zip code and a radius up to 250 miles by single miles. So you can really narrow in on your search. And then you get results. You look at, you scroll down and you see all the results with pictures and comments and full descriptions and the person who posted, the owner, can say, you know, there's room for lots of comments and description, anything about, you know, if somebody has found the pet, if they have any medical issues, that kind of thing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday now, and I'm talking with Marisa Finelli, founder and executive director of Pet FBI. It's a nonprofit website devoted to helping people find their pets of any kind of species. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Of course, we'll have a link to Pet FBI on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Now, you recently won a grant from Google to help advertise Pet FBI. What do you do? I mean, you've won grants from Google before. What do they enable you to do?
Well, in this day of information, this is the information age.
Overload, right?
Yeah, overload. When somebody loses a pet or even finds a stray, they're usually not thinking very straight. But if they have any presence of mind, they might go to the internet and look for reports of lost or found pets, you know, according to the situation. And how do you do that? Well, most people use Google. That's the primary search engine. I think the other search engines are really kind of overshadowed by Google's success. And it's phenomenal. I mean, speed of light, if you put in I lost a dog, you might get tens of thousands of matches. So the game is to, or the objective is to get your information up at the top, the first page of results. And this is where the Google AdWords grant comes in handy. By selecting certain search terms, the kind of words that people would use if they've lost a pet, and if it matches what your ad conveys, then your ad will come up. So usually if you do a search, the first ads are paid ads, and people don't realize how much money those ads cost. If you click on a paid ad, the advertiser might be paying anywhere from 20 cents to $20, even if it's something really hot, you know, everything, even if they don't buy anything or, you know, follow through and get the
service.
And they
only pay if there's been a click.
Yeah, and you pay for it's a pay-per-click. And so being a nonprofit, I mean, we had a budget last year of $20,000. We can't afford to, you know, buy advertising. We've never advertised. We've always depended on word of mouth. So this has been a real boon to us. Most of our donations go to vet care or what little bit, you know, well, actually, it's not a little bit anymore, but what it costs to maintain the website. Before it used to be, you know, vet, when we were doing more rescue and stuff, it was vet bills. So this advertising budget that we have from Google allows us to have our website come up as one at the top of the search results. The reason that's important is that for the database to work, for the people who have lost a pet and the people who have found it to connect, there has to be a critical mass of users. That's what we're striving for right now, is to find, you know, get enough people attracted to the site so that they connect. And we're doing very well in Ohio because we've been around since 1998. People know about us. Shelters are referring us. Rescues and all, they know about us. We have a 40% success rate in Ohio. In other words, 40% of the people who submit a lost or found report follow up by saying, yes, there's been a reunion. So that's real good. Nationally, it's under 20%, but it's growing every day.
Well, you just went national in 2014.
Right.
What was that transition like?
True. We've only been national for 2 years, and we completely revamped our website. We have a dynamite database developer, volunteer, who has donated his time and his expertise, and he's created what I think is the best database, the easiest to use. And I know it sounds like bragging or self-promotion, but I defy anybody to go out there, do a search on other lost pet databases, and you'll see that ours is really the easiest to use, the best, the quickest way to get to the information, and the most information. I check this periodically. Mm-hmm. We really do have more reports than any other database. And okay, yeah.
Paul in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Ann and Marissa. Say, recently had a beautiful standard poodle hit by a car in front of my house near Dawn, but no collar. So I called Columbus or Franklin County Dead Animal Pickup, and the man came out with the truck and saw no collar. I said, well, aren't you going to check for microchips? And I was told by the man that we don't have microchip checkers. I said, so these people who paid for a microchip, their dog's been hit, they're going to be searching on Pet FBI and putting up signs all over the neighborhood. Where do you think we could start in trying to get the dead animal pickup people to check animals for microchips and try to reduce our amount of woe over losing a dog and never knowing what happened to it?
What do you know about that, Marisa Finale?
That's unfortunate. I wasn't aware. You know, these scanners are free. The microchip companies give them to shelters and rescues for free. And it would be a simple matter to scan these dead animals for a microchip. Being a standard poodle, it might very well, you know, have a microchip. Mm-hmm. But here's an alternative source of information. We have an Ohio Facebook page, and surprisingly, a lot of people will report that they've seen a dead dog by the side of the road or give a description. We've even had some Facebook followers who will take the animal home or take a picture of it, give it a proper burial, and then post it on our Ohio Facebook page. And very often through that means we trace the owner. The owner, Facebook has phenomenal reach and works well on a local level if it's intensively local. Hmm. And ours is just mostly Central Ohio and Ohio. So that would be something you could do. Go to our Facebook page. It's Facebook/petfbi.org, and mention that that happened in front of your house. Okay. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the owner comes forward.
Paul, thanks for that call. Anyone else has a question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Having a website like this go national, let's talk about the transition to that. You said you're catching up nationally to your state numbers of 40% success rate. Right now it's at about 20%. But what about having a pet FBI in every state?
Well, we thought of that. I mean, it actually works that way because you can search by zip code. And it originally was just Ohio. The database was designed to only cover Ohio. And when we went national, well, the database scaled up so that no matter what state you're in, you can enter a zip code. If you find a zip code in the center of the state and put in a radius of 100 or 200 miles, whatever's appropriate for the size of the state, you will pull up all the lost and found or found records, whatever you're looking for, mm-hmm. from that particular area. So for all intents and purposes, there is a pet FBI. Ohio, there is a pet FBI for every state. Now, Facebook is another matter. There are a lot of Facebook pages that are dedicated to lost and found, and they work very well short term and only if they're really focused on a particular area. So we don't want to compete with that because the problem now is that there's already too many sources of information. They're scattered all over the web. We're trying to, you know, be the dominant source of information. And what we don't have as lost or found reports, we point people to. Mm-hmm. We're a nonprofit, so we can afford to link to other sites. And other sites don't do that. The mistake a lot of people make is that they'll just stop there. They do a search. They find a link. They like that link. They like that site. They'll post, and they'll stop there. We really encourage people to use all possible sources, not just online sources, but all kinds of techniques for finding a lost pet.
So you encourage them to take an active role in their pet search. Is there any way that people can go back in time that now learn about pet FBI and wonder if something had been posted 3 or 4 or 5 years ago when they'd lost a pet? Does your database go back that far?
Good question. And I'm so glad you brought that up because that is one of the unique qualities or unique assets of the Pet FBI database. We keep our records at least 4 or 5 years. So there are other sites, the lost and found databases, where after 60 days your post expires. That's it. You're not even reminded to renew it. No, you can go back and do a search. If you lost a dog back in 2013, you can do a search using that time frame. Whatever. Mm-hmm. January 1st to June 2nd, 2014, and you'll pull up all those reports that were posted in that time frame. As far as I know, we're the only site where that is possible.
And then as far as that active role, it's not just settling for what's on Pet FBI, it's doing more. You still want them posting on the telephone poles?
Oh, absolutely. That's, a tried and true method, and in the short term, that works really well. And we have also, as part of our advice, and this is another great asset for our website, we give extensive step-by-step detailed advice, action plan. And we have a page dedicated to the best way to create a poster. In fact, we have a template where you can create your own poster. You don't have to format it. You just put in the information and we create a poster for you. And then we have a page with information about or suggestions about the best way to use that poster, cover it with something that's that's going to be protected from the rain, how to attach it to poles, which places to post it, that kind of thing.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today and talking about Pet FBI.
Well, thank you. And, it's kind of pretty much a universal experience losing a pet or finding a stray. And we hope that more people will take advantage of this great resource.
Marisa Finelli is the founder and executive director of Pet FBI, which just won another grant from Google to help advertise Pet FBI. We'll have a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Most website links begin with HTTP or HTTPS. That S stands for secure, and it's often found with websites that handle money, such as banks or stores. Google and Mozilla are pushing websites to obtain more secure HTTPS connections, but that S may not even be as secure as some users think. Tech journalist Scott Gilbertson recently wrote about the S in HTTPS for ArsTechnica.com. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the difference between HTTP and HTTPS?
Well, basically, the S, like you said, stands for secure, and it uses an SSL socket layer, which is kind of a technical term for it encrypts your data, so no one can read what's going from your web browser to whatever site you're connecting to.
So why isn't encryption enough? Why is that not ideal?
Well, because it's only one part of the equation, particularly with sites that you're interacting with in some way, like your bank or Facebook or your email or something like that. The connection might be secure, but you really have no idea what's happening to that data once you've given it to the website. Like, is the server they're on already compromised, or is there some other person sitting like off to the side hacking your router or anything like that? You have no way of knowing that, and you never will. Nothing about HTTPS is ever going to tell you that information. So it's kind of misleading to say that it's totally secure if the connection is secure, but your data may or may not be secure.
I mentioned that Google and Mozilla are pushing to have HTTPS used across websites, even those that don't necessarily handle finances. Why are they pushing for it? Is just for another layer for their purposes?
Well, that's a good question. And it has a kind of complicated answer because there's a lot of layers to it. They're pushing for it, I would say, on one level, because it's good for the web. It makes sure that certain attacks that have already happened can't happen. There's something called the Great Cannon attack, which happened in China, but could theoretically happen anywhere, where innocent people who had no idea they were part of this basically were turned into attackers by injecting a piece of JavaScript into their browser. With HTTPS, that's not possible. The network in an HTTPS connection is essentially a dumb pipe. It's not, there's no way to snoop on it. So that's good. And then a lot of companies out there are sort of doing some somewhat nefarious things, like scraping Google's search results. So they gain a competitive advantage when they can do that. And HTTPS prevents that. So Google's very interested in stopping that. That's certainly part of their motivation. I couldn't speak to all their motivation, but there's that there. And then the EFF is, of course, working with, you know, whistleblowers and people like that who need to make sure their connections are secure and that they have a way to communicate without being snooped on.
Your piece describes two types of cyber attacks that go after HTTPS, the man in the middle and the DDoS. Can you tell us what's the difference between those and why they work the way they do?
Yeah, so both of those work on HTTP connections. They will not work on HTTPS.
Okay, sorry.
So a man in the middle is a code injection thing where basically your web browser is trying to connect to a website over an insecure connection, so you don't really know what's happening over that wire. Somebody could be in there listening, grab what you're sending, and then respond as if they were the website and inject little bits of code to take over your website, or just like, this is also kind of a business model. It's what Verizon and some other ISPs do. They inject advertisements. So that's kind of troubling for us, both a user and a content producer, because you don't know what ads you're delivering on your website are actually getting to your viewers, and your viewers don't know if those ads came from the website or somebody sitting in the middle. So HTTPS prevents all of that because you can't get in the middle. There's no middle to get to. It's all encrypted traffic. The other major attack that it prevents is the kind of, I'm trying to think of the best word. Think of it, there's like a state level sort of attack, which is not very common, although it has the Hollywood sort of glamour about it. But if, for example, in the article I talk about, Russia wanted to ban a Wikipedia article about hashish, but Wikipedia is served over HTTPS. So there's no way to see what page visitors are requesting when they go to the site. So Russia has to either ban all of Wikipedia or none of it. So it decided to ban none of it because blocking out Wikipedia entirely would be a bit extreme even for Russia. And then the last kind of attack I talk about in there is the Great Canon attack. And that is exceedingly clever. Basically, whenever someone visited the Chinese search engine Baidu, it had a bit of JavaScript code in there that they didn't put there. Somebody had hacked it. But it injected that JavaScript into the browser, and then every single browser that visited that site became part of a denial of service attack. So they just started pinging websites and knocking them out, even though those people had no idea they were doing that in the background. Mm-hmm.
And by making it secure with HTTPS, once again, it's just they don't have access that way.
Correct.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with tech journalist Scott Gilbertson about the S in HTTPS, why it matters, and why it doesn't go far enough, according to some. Scott Gilbertson, there are critics of the move toward HTTPS, the one being asked for by Mozilla and Google. They're saying it could break links to old websites, losing billions of links. Why is that the case?
Yeah, because there's all these links out there that existed before HTTPS was even possible in some cases. And so when the browser requests an HTTP link and it's been upgraded to HTTPS, it returns an error. It doesn't automatically translate that. Now, there's some development in the works to make it so that site developers can say, hey, everything on this site has been upgraded. So if you're following an old link, automatically upgrade. But even that doesn't help, like a basically abandoned content. I mean, I'm sure we all have old pages on MySpace or something like that that nobody is controlling at this point. They're just sitting there, and some of that content is still maybe of interest to someone, and it would potentially break if browsers did go all the way and say, we're not going to load HTTP links at all. But to be clear, for now, they're not saying that.
Mm-hmm. But they're implying that it would be better if they did. And the question of whether moving to that could affect the culture of the web has arisen, right?
Yes, absolutely. HTTPS is great, but it's also very complicated. And even developers who do this for a living have a hard time getting HTTPS right. If you go, there's a website for testing HTTPS connections, and it kind of rates A, B, C, D. Even a site like Facebook only gets a B on that. It's very difficult to do this stuff right. And in some cases, when you do it right, the only way you do it right is by excluding certain web browsers. Like the primary reason Facebook gets a B on that is because they want to make it possible for people with Internet Explorer 7, I believe, can still access the website. And they can't do that. If they make it fully secure the way they should, those web browsers are so old, they don't understand how things work at this point. And they would fail. So Facebook opts to be more inclusive to people and a little bit less secure.
Why is it so difficult to adapt to go from HTTP to HTTPS?
Because the secure socket layer is kind of... I wouldn't say it's an outdated technology. It's just... It was written a long time ago, and at this point, it's sort of layered into another protocol, so the S is added to the HTTP, rather than starting over from scratch and writing a new protocol that might have been simpler to work with. That's part of Tim Berners-Lee, the founder of the Internet. He's been somewhat, not critical of adding encryption to the Internet, but critical of HTTPS in particular. He thinks that encryption should be added to HTTP. And that way the links don't break, and you still get a secure web.
Well, is he wrong?
He's not wrong, but I would say that looking at the history of the Internet and how protocols are adapted and things like that, the messy solution tends to be the one that ends up working. it's sort of how the web has worked this far.
It's not an Occam's razor kind of a setup.
Right, exactly, yes.
Is it a concern that browser vendors could push the web into HTTPS by only displaying sites with secure connections, or does that go to the issue of the culture of the web?
Yes, I would say that goes a lot to the culture of the web. And I think that right now, I mean, Firefox and Google Chrome kind of hold enough market share that they can kind of sway things where they want.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if they start going in a direction that enough of your sort of, for lack of a better term, your savvy internet users want them to go, I think someone will say, hey, let's take this code and go write our own browser that still accesses this stuff. I mean, Firefox grew out of basically the shortcomings of Netscape. So it's entirely possible that if they went that direction, and again, to be clear, they haven't said they are, it just is a possibility. I think someone would break off and say, hey, let's write this browser that still works with these old links. And I think that the web browser makers know that, and they're not going to go that far.
So going back to your point that you made about how, like, Microsoft 7, I guess, couldn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
How many people are out there that are still using that generation?
I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, but I know it was less than 10% worldwide last time I looked,
uh-huh.
somewhere more around 6 or 7%, which is still obviously a significant number of people. And, you know, a lot of those people tend to be disproportionately outside of the United States and may not have, you know, their own hardware or whatever. They may be using an internet cafe or something, so they
right.
don't necessarily have control over all of that. But yeah, it's around 6 to 7%, I believe.
And I would imagine that a lot of those people are also very dependent on, say, their smartphone or whatever to do their banking and that sort of thing. That's emerging as a real thing in the developing world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, that's something we didn't even really get into mm-hmm. in the article, but all of these issues affect any application running on your phone as well. It's not just the web browsers. It's, you know, everything. And the applications on your phone are kind of even harder to know, you know, because it's totally transparent. You don't get even a green lock or anything. You know, you don't really, you just have to have faith in the maker of that application who, you know, chances are you don't know.
Could the government get involved in any way? Do you anticipate that?
They certainly could. I don't know that they would or not. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an answer for that one.
Mm-hmm. And so at this point, it's just sort of industry self-regulated, kind of nudging sort of a thing.
Yeah, and that was sort of one of the reasons I wrote the article, is because it's, tech industry has a certain enthusiasm about any new idea it has, and it tends to take them and just kind of run with them. And, you know, one of my goals as a journalist is to sort of say, hey, wait a minute, what about this?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, and I hope the article doesn't come across as negative, because I do think HTTPS is a good idea. I just think presenting it as, oh, this creates everything as totally secure is a huge overstatement.
All right. So you have HTTPS. What's next then? What's the next step for somebody? Is it affordable? Is it doable?
Yeah, at this point, if you have a website, it's certainly it's free. The EFF has a tool at a site called letsencrypt.org that you can look into. And most major web hosts, if you're running WordPress or something like that, any popular web host has slowly been integrating this stuff. So mm-hmm. I would say within a year or so, hopefully it'll just be you click a button and your website is secure.
Okay. Well, Scott Gilbertson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's Scott Gilbertson. He's a freelance tech journalist, and we'll post his article from arstechnica.com on our website at wosu.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Learning to code can be a challenge. Getting a foothold can be difficult just because there are so many options. And most programming languages have pre-written applications with little space for creativity for beginners. Apple has responded with Swift Playgrounds. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So Apple wants to teach coding to people in a way that's engaging and approachable. You know, I kind of got into the whole Minecraft thing with, I guess it was Microsoft. What does Apple do that makes it fun?
Well, this is a pretty similar concept, actually. The Minecraft thing that you saw was through Code Academy.
Okay, and, that's right.
Code Academy is a separate service as well. But the core behind a lot of the programming tutorials that we see that are out there today are kind of breaking down the basics, not necessarily of how to write code, but how to think about writing code, because that's really the important part is thinking about how you would approach a problem before you have even started typing anything. And so there's two different sessions that we saw announced earlier this year that is coming to iOS 10 and is available now to try out if you are part of the demo group, where it's called Swift Playground. And it's essentially, almost aimed at children initially, but it expands pretty quickly for these really basic tutorials on how to think about programming with small challenges to kind of execute on the things that you've learned.
This is important because Apple needs more programmers?
Everybody needs more programmers. I mean, the idea of not knowing how it is that the piece of technology that you're using works is something that is going to quickly become, kind of unacceptable in a lot of job markets. And so this is an important skill for anyone of any age to, at the very least, get a basic grasp on right now. And it's going to become increasingly important in the future. But Apple's play here is picking this language specifically. It's Apple's language for writing apps that play well in Apple's ecosystem. So it kind of contains you in that system where you're using Apple products to make things that work for Apple users.
What are some of the key features of Swift Playgrounds? People log on, what do they find?
The biggest thing that you're going to find is just really detailed tutorials and audio groups, almost podcast-like formats for explaining how it is these different structures work and how it is that you put things together inside a Swift Playground. And it goes from, going through a list and poking at, individual options that you can kind of almost click and drag in order to solve puzzles, to the ability to open the keyboard on the iPad or the iPhone and, write your own code examples by the end of it.
Wow. It works in a split view, right?
It can work in a split
okay.
view. If you're using it on an iPad, then you have the advantage of having that kind of larger screen. And if you're using one of the larger iPads, then that becomes significantly more advantageous in that you have a lot more space to see the kind of visual example, the almost video game-like presentation for the code that you're writing as you're writing it. That's not quite as functional on, say, an iPhone or an iPod. Or even the smallest of the iPads is a little cluttered to have it like that. But that is a format that Apple supports for this.
Now, we compared it earlier to the Minecraft approach that I'm familiar with. I haven't checked out Swift Playgrounds, but I will. How technical does the Swift Playgrounds get? Is it something that could take you? You said it quickly ramps up, and is it something you could apply? You could take an intermediate coding class without a problem after this?
I would absolutely think so. If you followed through the entirety of the Swift Playgrounds book, it starts off with a very beginner's focus. There are several programs that are available inside of Swift Playgrounds, and if you complete all of them and you're confident in your abilities, after doing so, then I would certainly think that you'd be ready for an adult programming course.
There's a coding course that's we hear about on 89.7. Sometimes they talk about an aptitude test. what do you think of an aptitude for something like this? Do you have a sense about that?
Like I said, a lot of the interesting challenges that we're facing right now when it comes to teaching people, you know, about programming is not so much teaching them that, you know, these are the individual pieces of code that you need to use in order to assemble something that you can then see on a screen. Mm-hmm. It's helping them understand, you know, how to write in this format as though you're learning another language, you know, under looking at it as a problem to solve and not as code to regurgitate that you've learned from an online course, which was a really early problem with a lot of these things. And so aptitude tests are kind of funny in that a lot of them, from my experience, don't necessarily teach you, or don't necessarily evaluate your ability to learn, which is a functional part of this experience.
Now, Swift Playgrounds from Apple and Project Blocks from Google both intend to inspire kids to code. Do you think these projects will reach kids who wouldn't normally have been drawn to computer coding? Is that kind of what they're shooting for, too?
Well, I think that this works really well with both Google and Apple's efforts in the classroom. You know, Google's done a whole lot of work this past year in particular with Chromebooks in classrooms, and Apple has been doing a lot of the same with MacBooks and iPads over the last couple of years. And so it you know, really would be up to the teacher in that situation, you know, showing what it is that these computers are capable of and then kind of introducing the student to a way to do things more. You know, the same could be said for at home. Mm-hmm. If you have a child at home who you feel like, you know, could benefit from this or would be interested. I don't know that it would encourage interest, but it would certainly, you know, foster interest.
Do you make your kids do 5 minutes of coding before they can go outside every day?
No, absolutely not. I have one. My oldest daughter is fascinated by the idea of coding. You know, the notion of making her own video game is something mm-hmm. that she's very interested in. My youngest daughter could not care less. Computers are a way for her to, you know, play music and do things. She is very, very different when it comes to that kind of thing. And so there are some unique challenges there.
We have talked, this will be our third week in a row, talking about Pokemon Go, but it's everywhere. I mean, it's just amazing since that first time 3 weeks ago when we talked about it, how it's exploded. And a lot of problems along with it. And now we talked initially about, you know, kind of conjectured how might commercial businesses tap into this. And T-Mobile is often offering customers unlimited data for Pokemon Go. What's the deal there?
So this is actually an extended part of what T-Mobile has been doing with a lot of their business, where they've taken these really active parts of their user base and kind of zero-rated the data that they use for those apps. So it started with music, where they said, as long as you're using this handful of applications on your phone, then none of the music that you listen to through those apps will count against your monthly data allotment. And then within a couple months, they upgraded that to video, where if you're using you know, Netflix or Hulu or something like that, as long as you're playing in standard definition and not in high definition, then that video that you're streaming does not count against your data. And so they've upgraded that due to the just incredible popularity of this game to Pokemon Go. If you're playing Pokemon Go as a T-Mobile subscriber starting today, actually, that will not count against your data at all.
And they're hoping to attract new customers that way.
They're more than hoping. It's worked over and over and over again. Yeah, this is a strategy that has worked for them repeatedly. And you know, there's a lot of questions when it comes to how all of that is okay. You know, there's some net neutrality arguments that get raised there. The FCC has so far not really stepped in to do anything about this, but it's a couple of interesting questions to be asked about, you know, how you know, businesses are able to function like that, especially with this example with Pokemon Go. Mm-hmm. You know, there are plenty of other games to be played that use your data, including ones made by the same company. Niantic makes a game called Ingress that works very, very similarly to Pokemon Go. And you know, as a consumer, it's hard to ask that question, you know, why would I play any other game if I can play Pokemon Go and know that it doesn't consume my data? And that's a weird red flag for kind of zero rating data for a specific application. It you know, kind of creates an unbalanced internet.
Well, how much data does Pokemon Go use? How does it working?
It actually uses surprisingly little data, so it's not like T-Mobile is giving up a whole lot for this to begin with. During some of our testing, we saw that over the course of a 2 and 3 hour period, you're only consuming, 100 megabytes or 200 megabytes of data if you're doing nothing but playing this game. And so it's not a tremendous amount of data when compared to streaming music or watching movies or something like that. Mm-hmm. But if you are a player on a budget, or if you are on a family plan and, you've been playing this game pretty actively, then, those little bits will absolutely add up.
So how's it going for you? Are you still guys out there still every day?
I'm not every day, but we spent a pretty fair chunk of the weekend playing. All of my kids and I have been out playing. We found just an incredible amount of people playing the game as well. It really is phenomenal to see so many people out and about and doing things, and it's so easy to spot who's playing the game.
Yeah.
And when you're out, so it's fascinating to see. I can honestly say I've never seen anything quite like this. It's been a lot of fun.
And there's a lot of happy stories about people who haven't been out of the house in a long time getting out for this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a big part of this game is the places that you go to interact with the different parts of the game are, historical landmarks and things like that. And then there are, I've met easily a dozen people in the last week who have found historical landmarks that they never would have found otherwise, living in this city for years, and have found it and really appreciated some of the things that they found as a result.
You've talked before about water-resistant phone models. I think you went to one of the tech shows that you went to, you watched them dropping it into a bucket of water or something like that. And now Consumer Reports recently tested the Samsung Galaxy S7 and found some problems. What do we know about what happened there?
Well, so the Samsung Galaxy S7 Active, which is the version of the Galaxy S7 that is designed to be, kind of a little more rugged and a little more waterproof and, just a little more life-proof than your average smartphone, has been released for a little while now, and Consumer Reports grabbed a couple of different, models of the phone and decided to test the theory that it could be under up to 5 feet of water for a half an hour without the phone taking any damage. Mm-hmm. And during their test in a pressurized environment where they didn't drop it in 5 actual feet of water, they dropped it in, 1 feet of water, 1 foot of water that was pressurized to simulate 5 feet of water.
Mm-hmm.
They found both of the phones that they tested it on were irreparably damaged before the half an hour was up.
Not good news.
Definitely not good news. When you hear, that something is waterproof, you definitely want it to be waterproof. And it's hard for me to be any kind of, fair judge here. I've taken that same phone and, thrown it in the deep end of my 10-foot deep pool and had my daughters dive after it as though it were a pool toy. which resulted in some really fun YouTube videos. But
I bet.
But at the same time, my phone is perfectly fine. I use it every day and there's not been any problems. So it's clearly not a, every single phone is guaranteed to have this problem, but it's obviously not as, it's not, guaranteed to be waterproof forever for every phone. And Samsung responded to this particular claim by Consumer Reports by saying, this is the reason that they have warranty replacements and repairs. And so if there are any problems like this, that Samsung is openly willing to replacing the phone without any concerns or charges or anything like that.
Was Consumer Reports, did it specify what the irreparable damage was, or was it just generally a meltdown?
It was two different problems. The first was a button failure where water had come in and damaged things so that, the buttons no longer worked and touching things stopped being functional. And the other was a complete screen failure. They by the time they had removed the phone from the water, you could see just all kinds of damage to the screen. And you could see visibly that there was water under the glass where you would normally go to touch, so it's obviously neither of those situations are great. It means that the phone is no longer functional for just about anything.
How big of a deal do you think being waterproof is? Ultimately, it was a big deal when cameras became waterproof. People really jumped on that. They had a lot of fun. You mentioned some pretty fun YouTube videos. But how big of a deal do you think this is going forward?
I think that what most people really want in a phone is for it to be splash proof. When you accidentally drop your phone in the sink while you're doing dishes and someone answers the call, or you drop it in a puddle, or you're one of those really just terrible people that accidentally drops their phone in a toilet because you're using your phone in the bathroom and you shouldn't be. I think that that's what most people look for is, you know, that kind of splash proof, spill proof, you know, someone knocks over a drink and your phone is on the table or something like that. They want to know that the phone is definitely going to survive that. And in those cases, the Galaxy S7 and the Galaxy S7 Active absolutely survive those things, no matter what you do. You know, if you, you know, do something casual like that, we're reaching a point where most phones will survive that without any issue or incident, but it's not a guarantee once you go beyond that. And that's where the problem is right now.
You wrote a pretty fun blog about making pizza and charging your phone with a camp stove.
I did. I had way more fun with that than I thought I was going to. And this is, I think, a lot of it because I was a Boy Scout growing up. And so my family and I did a lot of camping trips, even outside of the Boy Scouts. And one of the things that we've tried, I guess, probably a dozen times is trying to make pizza by the campfire. You know, we've used Dutch ovens and you know, foil wraps and things like that. And they always turn out kind of terrible.
Right.
There are no recipes for that turn out, you know, decent. At least from my experience. And so I kind of rolled my eyes a little bit when I got reached out to by this company called BioLite, who makes a camp stove that I've used before, but they made a pizza stone for this camp stove that allows you to go camping and make, you know, a wood-fired pizza on this stove. And the way that BioLite stoves are designed, it also has a battery on the side that uses the heat transfer from the stove to charge your phone. And it all worked really well.
You know, you have talked about BioLite on the program before, I remember. How does this work, though? I'm looking at a picture of it. How big is the BioLite stove and how big does the pizza turn out to be?
There are two different versions of the BioLite stove for most people. There's this small camping stove that'll fit in a camping backpack. And there's this larger base camp stove that is a little on the heavy side and really just kind of meant to be driven out somewhere and then set up and used. It stands probably, you know, 3 feet off the ground, and is really as wide as, you know, kind of your standard large pizza crust, the pizza stone that it puts on, and the stone, you know, acts as a great heat barrier for the fire that is coming from the stove underneath, and it has a dome lid that you put on that you know, kind of makes it act as an oven. And so as long as you're keeping an eye on the fuel that you're putting in the fire and keeping it at a steady temperature, you know, within 10 minutes, we had a pizza that was really incredible.
Now, what is the thing that looks like a tray sticking out from the where the wood's burning?
It's just it's a tray to hold the you know, the wood and sticks and kindling and things like that in place.
Okay.
So that you're pushing it out. And it kind of has this system where as you're pushing, you know, new wood in, it scrapes the ash out into this collector underneath of it so that you're not making a mess anywhere.
So are you hitting the Appalachian Trail anytime this season?
Absolutely, yeah. Not now because it's 95 degrees with 80% humidity here in Maryland right now, and I don't even like looking outside when it looks like that. But as we get closer to September, I'm absolutely going to.
All right, cool. Well, we'll see how it works then. Russell Holly, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. You can check all the links I've mentioned this hour on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. You can also check out All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.